Hello and welcome to Underscore, the podcast from ACL Allen, featuring leading experts in economics and public policy. I'm your host and the CEO of ACL Allen, Paul Hislop. We're joined here today by my colleague, Dr. Andy Chang. Andy recently penned an insight piece on how to leverage lessons from other sectors of government in reforming our justice systems, particularly with a focus on Victoria. Andy, how are you? It's great to have you joining the conversation here today.
I'm well, thank you.
Andy, I thought we might just kick off the podcast because I think this is a pretty interesting area. What is it that you think about our justice system that actually needs reform?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at some issues that are common across the different jurisdictions. There are some issues related to sort of criminal justice administration that are, you know, due to the different responsibilities that are held by the Commonwealth and the states. But there are also some of the justice system's reforms that are required by sort of individual states, and there are unique circumstances in there. And because I'm based in Melbourne and have been working with a range of Victorian reforms, I guess that's where my greatest insights are. But some of the things that we're talking about will be common to other jurisdictions.
So what are some of the reforms that you think we need to make? What is it about the justice system right now? Where are we going wrong and where can we improve things?
So in Victoria, there's been a little bit of a perfect storm over the last 10 years, I'd say, where sort of around 10 years ago, there was a review by a judge called Ian Callanan, who was also known as the Callanan Review. And this review had to do with parole. So I think there was a serious incident involving a very public and heinous crime committed by someone who was on parole at the time. And so following that, there were a range of reforms to the criminal justice system. And, you know, so that put pressure on the back end where fewer people were getting parole. And it's interesting because, you know, while it was a one-off that you know, someone on parole had committed a very, very serious and public offense. So I believe it was a rape and murder. And what happened was, due to the changes that were made, many people could now no longer qualify for parole. And that means people were ending up spending longer in prison and getting out without supervision, essentially. And then sort of more recently, about 4 or 5 years back, there was the Bourke Street incident. And then that reform following that incident resulted in changes to bail. So fewer people that were going into prison would qualify for bail. So the prison system particularly, or the correction system more generally, has been under intense pressure from sort of these two events where fewer people were getting out of prison under supervision and more people were coming in on remand and unsentenced because they couldn't qualify for bail. So both of these things cause sort of immense pressure on the prison system. And that means when you've got a system under pressure, it means the quality of the services are deteriorate. So fewer people would be getting the services or programs that they need while they were in prison. Fewer of them would benefit from good kind of exit planning and connection to other supports when they left prison. At the same time, when you've got a larger prison population, eventually they will all need to come out. And so services that are meant to support them when they come back into community are also being overwhelmed because there's not enough funding for them. More funding needs to go to the prison to keep it running. I think particularly for Victoria, it's been a difficult time.
It seems slightly unusual to me, who's not particularly involved with policy in the sector, that reducing the amount of people that are given bail before hearings puts a lot of pressure on the justice system. Is that partly because there's long periods between people being charged and actually going through the process of the justice system to have hearings and then be determined whether they're guilty or not? And is that part of the problem?
That is part of the problem, but for the most part, because of the court process and the trial process, there needs to be time. So, you know, if you are charged with a relatively serious crime, you need time for your lawyers to gather evidence. You need time for investigations to take place, and so on. And one of the problems, particularly with both bail and parole reforms that happened previously, was that particularly for bail, you know, many of the requirements that were put in place as part of the reform disproportionately impacted vulnerable and disadvantaged cohorts. So things like, you know, you need to have a fixed place of residence. So, you know, those who were homeless were out. You needed to have essentially people who could act as your guardians, for example. So people who were estranged from their families or didn't have families would not qualify. And it was things like that. So while they are all well-meaning, and you know, when you review the tragic case of sort of James Gargasulos, you'd think, well, all of those things would have potentially prevented him from committing that crime. But it's also disproportionately impacting a much larger group of people.
Yeah, so basically one of the key things that happened in Victoria was tightened up bail, more congestion in the prison system. So why not just build more prisons? Is that something that's not easy to do?
It is interesting because we did also a piece of work for the department when it came to, you know, doing like a cost-benefit analysis for different prison sites for expansion. It is very difficult because it takes time. It takes a long time, three or 4 years. Where you place the prison is also a problem. Communities don't like having a prison in the middle of the community. So you've got to find a place where, you know, where the community isn't as strongly opposed to it. But then, you know, if you build it miles and miles away, visitation becomes difficult. So prisoners don't keep in contact with their families. And that doesn't help when they have to come out. They don't have a support network. So it is a difficult process and a long process to build new prisons.
In the insight piece, a lot of the flavour of it, I think, is your sense is that a big key part of success of the justice system is once prisoners have done their time, let's use that sort of term, coming back into the community, transitioning back into the community, that seems to be a critical point, how they transition back into the community. And I think you seem to be saying that there's some real problems, particularly in Victoria, about how those transitions are managed. And some of it's to do with maybe capacity, but it also seems that some of it might be to do with a bit of siloing of responsibilities and the justice system not being able to have control over some of the things that are substantially important in terms of the transition.
Yeah. So, and this goes back to the point, Paul, that I sort of highlighted about parole. So the way services are funded within prison, so if you're part of, if you are being supervised by the prisons, by the correction system, whether in prisons or in the community under a parole order or community corrections order, you have access to services that are funded by the State Justice Department. And these are different from services that are funded by the rest of the state or by the Commonwealth. But these things cover very important things like mental health, like employment. So what often happens is when people are in prison or being supervised in the community under an order, they have access to alcohol and drug programs that are good for them, that will help them to hopefully manage their addictions. They've got access to mental health programs. But what happens when their sentence ends is that all of that just gets dropped off. And then they come into the community system where it's difficult, one, to navigate the system, and you don't have someone doing it for you. So you don't have like a case officer who will help you organize things and just say, you know, turn up at this place at this time and you'll be looked after, right? So you've got to do that yourself. And well, many people from vulnerable and disadvantaged cohorts aren't very good at doing that themselves. And secondly, it's just a different system. and you've got to wait, you know, if you're in the public system. Many of them won't have the resources to get services privately. So that kind of transition between access to services that are funded by the correction system back to community, that's where a lot of difficult things happen. And sort of leaving prison, not under supervision, is a really important point. And I remember some work by Stuart Kinner out of the University of Melbourne. And he worked with us while I was working at Justice at the time as well. There are many, many preventable deaths for prisoners who come out of prison, and because they had used drugs before. And now leaving prison is a stressful time. They don't know where to go. They're homeless and they relapse. And many of them overdose at that point because they've been clean in prison for varying amounts of time. And then they go, right, I used to do this amount, and they just use drugs and then overdose because, you know, the tolerance that they built up is no longer there. So it's really that kind of handover and the divide between the corrections-funded system and the system funded by the state and Commonwealth is a really big problem. And it's a problem that's not unique to Victoria. So that's the one thing. And then the second thing is just the capacity of the service system to handle that increased population of people leaving prison or transitioning out of community corrections or parole. It's just difficult. And many of the mainstream services sometimes find it difficult, sort of whether rightly or wrongly, that they don't feel well equipped to deal with people who have a criminal background or history. Again, sometimes they don't have to disclose if they've been out in the community for a while, but very often when we suggest things like, you know, if you're leaving the corrections funded system, there should be some kind of handover to the community system. That's where it can become a little bit difficult because people who are working in the community system go, oh, firstly, we're not funded to deal with forensic clients. Secondly, it's a different skill set. You know, these people are perceived to be higher risk. And so that can be a bit difficult.
I've got to say, I'm a bit surprised that there's not more of an interface and that there's not more support systems, particularly for, longer-term prisoners who've spent quite some time within the justice system. And for all of us already, you know, the world is moving at a fast pace. And I know that prisoners aren't entirely cut off from the world within the prison system, but they're certainly not having to deal with making all the normal decisions that we all have to make in our daily lives. 10 years in the justice system, the world can look quite different when you come back out again. And as you say, I think to sort of use my language, there's a little bit of institutionalization of people who are basically become used to people deciding how they live their everyday lives, and suddenly they're back out in the real world and having to make all those decisions for themselves, and that can be very confronting. And then, you know, you top that off with people that are coming out of the system, as you mentioned, with mental health issues or with addiction issues or, other disadvantaged type issues. I'm a bit surprised that governments haven't got more sort of systems to help people transition, including guides from the justice system that guide them back into the other systems. But is that ultimately a budgetary issue that the governments just decide they can't afford it, or is it they've decided that it's not worth doing? What's going on there?
I mean, part of it is that divide. So basically, as long as you've got a different funding source and a different funding stream that have different eligibility criteria, you're always going to have this is for them and that system is for them and that system is for us. There have been sort of sporadic attempts at kind of joint funding, so justice and health co-fund like a program, but I think structurally as well there are broader kind of structural impediments that we need to get through. I have heard or read a few things around proposed reform that allow prisons to assess Medicare, for example, like, you know, health is health. Why should it matter what circumstances you're in? You know, access to health services should be universal.
Or to public housing or to, you know, mental health services or, yeah.
Yeah, But I think the way, in a way, you know, the health system and the services system are used to doing things a particular way, changing or overhauling the entire structure of how we deliver health and community services will be, I think, very difficult. And it also needs to have a common will among both Commonwealth and all the different states to do this.
But that's kind of almost saying that all these systems are siloed and we just have to accept that they're going to remain siloed and there's not much we can do. Surely there's some things that can be done to overcome this.
Yeah, and I think, look, the first thing that I'd say is there have been lots of efforts to do this. So I can think of at least a few I don't know whether some projects actually that were either proposed or actually implemented that look at, you know, having a support system essentially for when they leave the correction system. So having like a case manager within like a non-profit, like a VACRO or one of the larger ones like Anglicare, you know, to sort of give them a little bit of a softer landing. So have someone who will be able to assist them to, you know, navigate service systems, make appointments, that sort of thing. But sometimes some of the things that have happened and are sort of common across different service systems, not just justice, are things like housing, the lack of housing stock or lack of public housing, whether it's children transitioning out of home care, prisoners leaving prison, people fleeing family violence, you know, all of those different groups run into the same problem when it comes to, say, housing stock.
Yeah, well, I mean, the lack of public housing in Australia is a whole other issue. We could do a whole podcast on that as well, I think, you know.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, you know, you can have the capacity to fund some of these services that might be useful in helping people to transition out, and they can work more effectively when working with people with the staff in the justice system to do their planning if they have that capacity. But if they don't, you know, it's trying to drink out of a water hose and it's just difficult. So for example, you know, coming back to the changes to bail, because people were in bail for minor issues, by the time, so they might have been in prison on remand for 6 months or 8 months. And when they finally get to the courts, the magistrate hands down the sentence of 8 months and off you go. You know, you're released from essentially from remand
because of time
as a
served.
Sentence prisoner, because of time served.
Yeah.
But what happens because you are on remand, you don't get access to all of that exit planning. No one knows how long you're going to be here because...
So remand is actually quite different to a known sentence, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't get access to, say, sort of the criminogenic programs. So things that are programs that are designed to change your behavior because, well, technically, the old thinking was if you haven't been sentenced, we can't actually be sure that you've actually committed the crime. So, you know, if you eventually prove to be not guilty, why have we wasted the program space on you compared to someone else who's actually been sentenced and proven guilty?
But not accepting that the process of then people being on remand is in itself a process that needs management.
Yeah. So many of them end up with time served being released without access to the exit planning, for example, because they've been in there for a longer period of time, like 6 to 8 months, their rentals have lapsed and they've been kicked out of their accommodation. Mm-hmm. You know, so they've come out with nothing to their name. I don't have a house to return to anymore. All my belongings were chucked out by my landlord. I don't have access to services.
No job.
Yeah, so I think the bail reform in particular has really impacted many of these people who, if they could access bail, had a fighting chance of, you know, living a relatively normal life, but because they couldn't, end up in much greater trouble than they first started.
And I think you can understand why the community. I mean, I remember the crime, first crime you mentioned in particular. I think it was a chap that was on parole. I think he raped and murdered a woman late at night. I think that's the one you're talking about. And I remember the outcry. You know, you can see the community wanting judges and courts to crack down on, not give these sorts of people the parole. And then I think it's very difficult for the judges within the justice system, you know, when they're presented, because, you know, we generally give them a lot of discretion. And I think that's quite appropriate. We want them to have discretion and be able to take individual circumstances into account. But I think sometimes it's really quite difficult, you know, when you're sitting with a person in your court trying to judge whether or not bail is appropriate or not, and whether or not they're likely to commit another crime or whether they'd like to behave themselves while on bail. And then the response by governments to turn around and basically take that discretion away. And I think that's pretty much what you're saying has happened in Victoria. The tail has caught this huge sort of mass of people. You can understand why governments have done it, but yeah, it seems way over the top.
As difficult as it is, you know, particularly when within the community emotions are running high, for example, and people are scared, and understandably so, and therefore, you know, governments do need to respond and to be seen to be responding appropriately. It can be really, really difficult to sort of make those decisions. I think even without any policy change, judges and magistrates are part of the community too, and they're human too, and they'll be hearing all of these things. They will have been more risk averse in making their decisions anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, better to not give 10 people bail than to be found to have let one out that's caused a horrendous crime, yeah.
But at the same time, magistrates and judges see these cases sort of day in, day out, and they will have a reasonably, I think, a much better idea of you know, yes, we've let one out, but if I were to do this, how many other people would it impact, for example? Look, it's a really difficult one, and the thing is, if governments are not seen to be responding appropriately because of our kind of political system, it will get used to, it will be weaponized by the opposition or the opposing government of the day. And, you know, I think you can hear sort of many things that are being politicized out of, you know, the current debate on the voice to parliament. I think it's very difficult when human issues or social issues become politicized, and particularly for the justice system, it's very difficult to manage sort of community expectations, particularly when emotions are running high. And certainly, you know, from a policy point of view, many of these kind of other impacts were being thought about at the time when they had to be implemented. And particularly in the public service, the thinking was, you know, how can we implement what the government is trying to achieve while trying to minimize the impact on other cohorts, for example. But at some point, it does become too difficult and people will get dragged in by these reforms.
I'm not really close to the justice system, as you know, but my sense, though, from what I have read sort of briefly, is that the cost of maintaining prisons and the cost of each individual prisoner in a prison is really quite a high cost, just because the amount of supervision and management that's involved. Where's the thinking around people coming out of the prison system, not making a good transition, and then basically falling back into the prison system? I mean, has there been much work done on that? And has anyone sort of had a close look at the costs and benefits, you know, just to sort of put a really sort of hard sort of nosed approach to it? Paying for a better transition process as distinct from having the higher levels of recidivism?
Oh, there are lots of different studies that have been done. And sort of any time you've got a program or an intervention that's aimed at keeping people out of prison, it always comes down to that, you know. The Australian Institute of Criminology have done a range of kind of cost-benefit analyses. It definitely makes sense to invest in programs to prevent people from coming back in. But I think there are two things that we've already sort of covered. One is these programs only work if you have the right, if they can be managed at the right capacity. Secondly, with the amount of funding that's, say, already committed to other things like, you know, infrastructure projects, schools, like education and health, and, you know, sort of any money that was coming into justice was going into increasing the capacity through expanding prisons.
Mm.
Because in the short run, because of those policy changes, you had to. I remember for a period of time, the prison's capacity was so problematic that people were, who were not sentenced, were sometimes held in police cells. And the police weren't happy about that because, you know, then...
No, well, those systems, they're not designed for long-term holding of prisons.
Yeah, they're not designed for that. And it meant that, you know, police had to dedicate resources to watching them and taking police off the streets, etc. They weren't happy. So you know, the fallout of a policy decision can be really huge, including things like, you know, your funding and investment going into things that don't solve the problem, like building more prisons.
If the analysis shows that there's longer-term savings through having reduced need for, you know, managing prisons and also the cost of going through courts of recidivism by actually investing more money up front, is one of the things that's limiting it literally just short-term budgetary concerns?
I haven't looked at the sort of budget allocation and where it's going for a while. I think that's part of the problem, but there's also another part of the problem that's within the broader service sector. So again, this is also covered in the Met Royal Commission into the Victoria's mental health system, that, you know, our service sectors, like the mental health sector, is under immense pressure as well. There aren't enough people who are well equipped to work in that workforce. So the Victorian government has obviously invested a lot more into building up that sector, as well as the workforce in that sector. But any kind of reforms that involve workforce take years before you see the results. And considering that, you know, we're also have done and are doing a range of different things in that area around, you know, the mental health workforce, these things are only just beginning to sort of take shape and be implemented properly. So it is a while away. And eventually when that sector gets built up, part of the challenge is then, you know, how do you make sure that you service both the community sector and the forensic sector the same? How do you join them up properly? So there's further work to be done down the road, but there are sort of capacity constraints in the workforce as well.
So, I mean, you could, a slightly venal view would be that those long-term, taking a long-term for those benefits to flow, for a government that's on a 3 or 4 year election cycle, there's a reduced incentive for them to do something about it because those benefits may turn up for a different government and they may not get the kudos for it.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that's what's happening, but you can see those incentives are there.
I can't definitively say for sure whether this is why, you know, problems are left till they are so serious that they require a royal commission, and then it takes a royal commission's recommendations to move a government to action. You know, ideally that shouldn't be the case, but certainly we're seeing more and more of the kind of human and service sectors ending up down that path. You know, Queensland had a child protection commission of inquiry not so many years ago. It feels like housing in Queensland is coming to a head as well. And the few people that I've encountered in doing the family and child commission review have been advocating very strongly. So the CEO of QCOS is very active on my LinkedIn feed, I must say. So coming back to a previous point that I made, you know, human and social services can end up suffering when it becomes politicized.
Yeah, no, I get that point and I can see that point. I mean, one of the big part of your thesis is that there's a whole bunch of things that have been done in other social sectors, particularly around family violence and mental health. And I think you're saying there's some things that we've done in those sectors, particularly in Victoria, that we can translate and use within the justice system? I mean, what are the sort of things that you're thinking about there?
So sort of going back to, I guess, some of the things that I outlined in the insight piece, which is firstly, understanding that, you know, when you're trying to solve a wicked problem, it can't be done by a single agency. You know, different services need to be included and on board and sort of working to reach the same goal. That can be difficult. And I'm thinking, you know, in the current climate where everyone's got their own reform agenda to implement, that just leaves less room or less capacity to undertake some of these other things that require more effort, like intergovernmental collaboration. The second thing is sort of understanding that reforms need to be sort of human-centered and human-focused. And what that really means is just taking a kind of a needs approach and addressing those needs for people.
Tailoring solutions.
Yeah, tailoring solutions. Yeah, to individuals and it can be hard because when you design programs, you have to have like an eligibility criteria. You've got to work out how funding needs to be allocated and for whom. Particularly with the justice system, it dehumanizes people who go through it. And sometimes, you know, you do hear stories around people finding it difficult just because they've got a criminal history.
Well, I mean, part of the justice system, though, is punitive. You know, I mean, it's not just reforming, is it? I mean, there's two elements to it, and maybe that's one of the complications of the justice system.
It is. If you think about sort of punishment and discipline more broadly, not just within the criminal justice system, there really isn't a point for punishing someone if there isn't a way back for them. So anything from, you know, disciplining your children or disciplining students in a school, the point is to get them to re-engage, not to disengage with mainstream society. So have we gone too far in the punitive aspects of it?
Well, maybe that's too having a better tailored justice system, because I imagine there are some people within the justice system where there may be no way back anyway, or the way back is so hard that it's almost impossible. So, you know, maybe there's too much of a one-size-fits-all within the prison system itself.
I think, again, you know, the capacity of staff, and this goes to the third point in the insight piece, which is, you know, do staff, both within the justice system and in the community, are they well-equipped and resourced to work with these individuals? And some of them will be, as you say, a lot more difficult to shift. But there are a genuine proportion of people who are in the justice system that are looking for a way out, that with a bit of help, you know, and with a little bit of assistance, can get back to their feet. And many of the things, I think with social and community services, it's a bit like a domino, right? That are being done in prisons, like, you know, education and employment programs, partnering with industry to give them, you know, sort of jobs that they can go to once they leave prison, give them transferable skills, etc. But when they leave prison, if they can't get accommodation, everything just falls through. So if you don't have a place to go home to, how do you go to work? So what if I have a job? So what if I have skills? And once that stress comes on, it's like a domino. Then your resistance or your desistance to substance abuse goes, right? So it's like a domino effect. Once you don't have a house, your employment falls through. Once that piles on the stress, your desistance to substance use goes through. And then it cycles, it spirals. So it's a really difficult problem to make sure that all of those things kind of stay relevant and viable for individuals that are leaving the justice system, which are not helped by sort of broader issues around public housing, for example.
Yeah. I think you, in that discussion, you made a couple of really good points too. It's not just the people that are being retained within the justice system. It's the very large workforce that we need to help actually run the justice system and to run it effectively. And that means, you know, high levels of skill and experience. And not only that, and not overloading them and making them feel oppressed and feeling like their job is hopeless as well. Because, you know, there are so many other options for people in terms of their working lives. We need to make that aspect of the justice system attractive as well. Otherwise, the whole thing can't work.
Yeah. And you can see, you know, I mean, many of the kind of recruitment activities within the justice system is like, you know, you can make a difference to people's lives. And genuinely, that is the case. The people who are working in the justice system and the correction system are the role models or are the people who will essentially socialize criminals back into society. And if they don't have the capacity to do that, if they're sort of just constantly trying to deal with sort of problems or juggling their capacity and workload, it's just not going to work. And if they are under stress and it doesn't bring out the best in people, and that's what prisoners are looking at. And there's a lot of stuff that I think people who work in prisons are asked to do and to be responsible for. Again, I'm not saying, you know, throwing money at the problem is the be-all and end-all, but I think there needs to be recognition that in order for them to have the intended influence that they should have on people, you do need to give them the right skills and the right workloads.
Yeah, I agree. Andy, that's been a terrific conversation. Thank you for joining me today. I very much appreciate it.
Not a problem, Paul. It's been a pleasure to revisit some of the things that, you know, I had learned not just as a criminologist and researcher at university, but also some of the stories I heard while I was working in the Department of Justice. Again, you know, I think a better justice system, it benefits everyone in society. And, you know, the better we can make it, the better it is for everyone.
I agree. Thanks, Andy. And thanks to everyone for joining us today. Tune in next time for another insider take on what's happening in the headlines. Or alternatively, you can visit acelallen.com.au for more in-depth articles and insights.